all her blanks up. So we're going to talk briefly. You have handouts on Erickson and Piaget. You have majority of the information that we're discussing. You've already got it. I mean, it's written out here for you. And then, let's see. But I will embellish or add to that. I'm not going to sit there and read this to you. As I said, you do have this. Let me see where it is. So I can pull it up for you. So, let me see, share. Okay, so this is the screen I'm sharing. This is what you have. You have this posted in Moodle. It basically goes through, and Erickson is the theorist we tend to revert back to for our pediatrics. Most of the things we talk about, we talk in terms of Erickson. Piaget is another one, and Piaget is really one that helps us in regards to teaching and educating our client. So these are the basic stages according to Erickson. We have trust versus mistrust, and that's infant birth to about 1 year, and it tells you everything about the infant. Infants and babies, of course, we know need to feel safe and secure. They need to be taken care of, and they need to have all their needs met. When they are not met, it could be very harmful to the infant as this infant grows. The other thing we talk about with infants do not always have tears. That's a question. Do they always have tears when they cry? No, they don't. Infants can cry and not cry tears, not because they are dehydrated, but because they're basically complaining, because that's the only way they have to communicate with us. So sometimes they'll cry and there's not a tear in their eyes. That's not to say they're not upset or they're not whatever, but they don't always have tears. And that is kind of a normal finding with our newborns. We know their breathing is not always regular and even. It's not. They are erratic breathers a lot of times, but they're not always, their breathing is not always regular and even. These babies are birth to 1 year, need to be fed and loved and cuddled. We said something earlier about not propping bottles. We know we don't prop bottles, leads to an increased risk of otitis media, can lead to when they have teeth and everything, we have to worry about baby bottle mouth and things like that. But we don't prop bottles. We don't. We don't warm bottles in the microwave. That's just a big no-no. And when we weigh, and we've talked about it previously, we weigh and we record our weight in kilograms. If you're weighing them like in assessment, perhaps, you can weigh them in pounds and tell the parent, oh, they weigh whatever. But when you record it, we record things in kilograms. So remember that. That's very, very important. The next stage is autonomy versus shame and doubt. That's our toddlers. They begin to assert their independence. They'll walk away from mom. They'll pick which toy to play with. They'll make choices about what they wear, what they eat, etc. So these are our toddlers. They're discovering that they have skills and abilities, etc. So they're going to learn these things as it goes on. this age, we need regular doctor appointments for well baby checks. We need to answer their questions using, again, appropriate terminology for age. We need to be sure and give them two choices, not four. And I know Ms. Wood said something about that as well. We don't want to give them a gazillion choices. You don't ever, in the hospital in particular, or wherever, when you're giving medication and you're giving oral medication, you don't want to say, do you want to take this with apple juice, or do you want to take this with Sprite? Because more often, 9 times out of 10, the child is going to say Sprite. And if there's not a Sprite in the room that you can give them, you're going to carry yourself down to the vending machine and you're going to be buying a Sprite. So we don't give them a gazillion choices. They're not good at making choices. So do you want this or this? Don't show them 15 outfits, this or this, basically. Because they're learning how to make choices. Can they read? Most likely, no. We know they're wary of strangers, and we talked about that separation anxiety, but they're normally wary of strangers. This is perfectly normal. It's normal they can suck their thumb or their passy or whatever. That's normal. It's a soothing behavior for these kiddos. No matter what the Academy of Pediatrics or whoever says, I still think it's something that needs to be stopped at age 2. We shouldn't be prolonging that, and we should be getting beyond that. As far as they always said, it was going to mess up your teeth, you were going to need braces, da-da-da-da-da. But the longer you wait, the harder it's going to be to get rid of. But realize it is a soothing behavior for them. They should be able to speak about 15 words. They should be walking, and that'll vary. Maybe you're going to have early walkers. You might have late walkers, etc. So you're going to have differences in regards to that. So be very aware of that, because you will see things that are different. But they should be walking. They should be pulling up. They should be doing that. Some are earlier. Some are later. Some are pulling up before a year. Some are walking by a year. Hang on, y'all. I'm sorry. What's up? Can't talk. Bye. Sorry. But they should be walking by that age. The next is initiative versus guilt. These are our preschoolers. These are 3 to 5 year olds. They're interacting regularly with other children at school, hopefully. Play is very, very important. And I know Ms. Wood talked about play. They ask a lot of questions, Why is the sky blue? Why did we do this? Why is this? Why is that? So they ask a lot of questions. So we don't want to say, oh, you're just being a nuisance or something like that. We want to try to answer their questions, and hopefully we can redirect them and move on. The next one is identity versus role confusion. These are our 12 to 18 year olds. They've got a lot of stuff going on. Our 12 to 18 year olds are trying to transition from childhood to adulthood. They're becoming more independent. They think of themselves more as adults and not so much as children. But again, they've got a lot of stuff going on. Our adolescents are risk takers, or they don't believe if something's going to happen, it's not going to happen to them. It's going to happen to somebody else. So they're the ones that we really kind of have to. I skipped over 5 to 12 year olds, didn't I? Industry versus inferiority. Okay, industry versus inferiority are 5 to 12 year olds. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to skip over that. So the peer group gains greater significance for these kiddos, and they become a major source of the child's self-esteem. They have a lot of things going on at this age group. I always tell the students, if another child is going to, we talk about bullying a lot, or we start thinking about bullying, are you being bullied, or are you the bully? If they say, no, I'm not being bullied, but are you the bully? Bullying is a great big deal, and other kids are going to pick on you. They're going to pick on you if you're too tall. They're going to pick on you if you're too short. They're going to pick on you if you're too skinny. They're going to pick on you if you're too fat. They're going to pick on you if you wear glasses. They're going to pick on you if you don't wear glasses, if you wear braces or if you don't wear braces. They're going to find a reason sometimes, or some children will, to pick on them. And that is very, very important to them because their peer group is so essential. We need to be talking to kids at this age. They can understand us and they can verbalize what is wrong. So we need to find out what is going on with these kiddos. Again, I'm sorry, back to identity versus role confusion. We've got a lot of things going on in this age, as I said, and we need to be sure and ask those probing questions to these kids. We need to find out what's going on with our adolescents. Don't just dismiss things without finding out more. Bullying is huge at this age. Suicide is another great big thing. And we've all seen stories on TV or heard of things where a child or a teen killed themselves because they were being bullied or they were being told to, or any number of reasons. So there's a lot of things that they have going on at this age and stage. So we have to think about that. So next we have Piaget. And we know that these theories and theorists are attempting to explain human behavior. Piaget was a Swiss theorist. He made major contributions to how children learn. His work provides a basis for learning about and understanding cognitive development. His theory is especially significant to nurses as they develop teaching plans of care for children. And he believed learning should be geared to their level of understanding and that they should be active participants. And we've said that off and on all day long. So this is the same chart that I have. And so if you think about it, 0 to 2, Piaget calls the sensory motor stage. And we realize infants, when they're thinking, infant thinking seems to involve the entire body. Reflexive behavior, which they start out with, everything is a reflex, and you'll learn about a lot of those reflexes in OB. But they have all this reflexive behavior, and that is then replaced with more complex behaviors as we go on. Yeah? You can see. But that's what we need to realize. They begin to develop object permanence. And my story about object permanence is young babies, about 8-9 months of age, when they're sitting there and you're playing with them, when you play peekaboo, if you put your hands in front of your face and you do this, if they can't see you, they don't believe you're there. So they don't have an understanding of object permanence. A lot of babies at this age might cover up their heads. Like we're talking, you know, 1-year-olds and whatever. But they'll take a blanket and they'll cover themselves up. And of course, we play along and we'll go, where are they? Where did they go? Because they don't have an understanding of that object permanence. And they do start to develop that later on, or closer to 2 years of age. But early on, they don't know that. They learn entirely through their movements and the sensations that result. And these are, they learn these things, that they exist separately from the objects and people around them. They don't come into this world knowing that, but they do learn that. Pre-operational language becomes more useful in this 2 to 7 year old. Their thinking is very egocentric during these early stages. They have magical thinking. And what I mean by magical thinking, events occur because of wishing. So they wish for something and then it occurs, and that, and something happens, but that's, they think that's a result of what they thought, that they kind of wished it into being. I always use a movie, especially now Christmas is past, I always use a movie, Home Alone, when Kevin is just like, I wish my family would go. I wish, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then when they leave him behind, he wakes up the next morning and it's like, I did it, kind of deal. So that's kind of an example of magical thinking. He's older there, but still, that things occur because of wishing. And they believe in animism, that objects have life and feeling. And these are really important in this, in this stage. These kind of characterize this stage, that so if they have a doll or they have a bear or something in the car with them, they might want that car put in with a seatbelt. They might want you to put the seatbelt on the car. If you say, leave your baby in the car while we go into the store, then he's like, we'll put a seatbelt on the baby to keep the baby secure here in the chair, and everything's going to be okay. And that's because of this animism, that objects have life and feeling. So we need to realize that, especially in this age group. Concrete operational, 7 to 11 years, they're able to see things from different points of view. They imagine events that occur outside their own lives. So they shift from that egocentric thinking, from the me, 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 to looking at the world from somebody else's view. The concept of time becomes increasingly clear, whereas it's not so much when they're younger, and their reasoning powers increase rapidly, but they still can't deal a lot of times with abstraction. So they can order objects, as it says on the right, by size, color, gradient, etc. They understand if 3 plus 4 equals 7, then 7 minus 4 equals 3. So they're understanding that, and they still have some problems with some abstractions, that a wide cup can hold the same amount as a tall, thin cup. Formal operations, again, is 11 years on. Around the onset of puberty, they're able to reason in much more abstract ways, proceed from concrete to abstract and symbolic, from self-centered to other-centered, and they're able to problem solve and deduce a lot more. Miss Wood just came and brought me water. They're able to problem solve and deduce a lot more as a result. So that is the theorist at a glance, or very, very briefly. There's only a couple, let me stop sharing this screen. I hate it when you're sharing, because then I can't see what's popping up. I have emotions for the first blank, but still don't have the one for a transition blank. Oh, that's language development. So I don't know if that's pertinent to me or not. But anyway, so that was trust versus mistrust. The last thing I would like us to cover, and again, I have updated it, shortened it, whatever you wish to think about it. Of course, now I have to find it. Excuse me while I fuddle around with papers, which I know y'all hate as much as I do. Oh, got it right here. So we're going to talk a little bit about fluid and electrolytes. The funny thing about fluid and electrolytes, if you would like to consider it, the book doesn't have anything specifically titled fluid and electrolytes. So I always start off this discussion about fluid and electrolytes by saying, okay, you think back to second level. You've had fluid and electrolytes since you got into this program. You had it in patho, you had it in first level, you've had it in second level. So again, we're going to talk about it briefly in third level, but not to a great extent. You do need to remember the things from second level as far as think about your values. What are our values for sodium? Since we're WebExing.
135 to 145.
There you go, 135 to 145. Potassium?
3.5 to 5.
Calcium?
8.6 to 10.2.
Okay, I've got 8.5 to 11. So in that range, okay. What about our pH? 7.35 to 7.45. Perfect. Is if I have a pH below 7.35, am I looking at an acid issue or a base issue?
Acid.
Acid. And if I'm above 7.45, of course it's more alkaline and I'm considering base, right? Perfect. Y'all got that. We need to remember that IV fluids are considered medications. Sometimes we forget that, but IV fluids are actually considered medications. So your handout is posted. I updated it. I deleted some things. If you went ahead and prevented, if you went ahead and printed the previous one, just take a pencil and X out everything until you get to blood products. And blood products should be a review. Okay? So we're going to pick up with blood products. And we use blood products. We know we use blood products. We use packed red blood cells to increase oxygen carrying capacity. The indications for use are there. Blood products are considered pretty much plasma expanders because they can increase blood volume. And these are also more expensive. It's more expensive to do blood products or plasma expanders because of the cost, but it is more expensive and there are higher risks associated. So packed red blood cells we typically use. They can use fresh frozen plasma. They can use whole blood, any of these things. We need to remember, and again, I said this is just a review, and that's all basically it is. We need to remember what fluid do we use to administer blood products?
Normal saline.
That's it. End of discussion. We use normal saline when we're doing blood. What are some other little caveats with blood? How many nurses have to check your blood products?
Two.
It must be hung within how many minutes of getting blood products on the floor?
30 minutes.
So that means I don't think I'm going to go hang my blood. I'm not going to go get it until I'm ready, right? Because I'm not going to take it and put it in the refrigerator or do anything else with it. So it has to be hung within 30 minutes of getting it. Needs to be hung with blood tubing or whatever tubing is appropriate where you're at. It must be given over a period of no more than 4 hours, because we don't want a risk of sepsis as a result. So that's just a little review, and y'all remembered that. The same thing with potassium. Potassium's on here as well. And I mention these because they are very, very important to what we do. So we did the normal potassium. 95% of the potassium is found inside the cells. It is used to treat hypokalemia. And I listed the signs and symptoms of hypokalemia out there if you forgot. Never give potassium IV push. Ever, ever, ever. You always dilute it and infuse it over several hours. You always try to use a central vein if possible. You know why?
Burns.
It burns. Thank you very much. It does. You can give a person too much potassium. And if you do that, you have to give them K-exalate, which lowers the blood level of potassium by binding to it in the intestine. So, I mean, that's giving potassium. Of course, if IV fluids are drugs, then potassium, of course, is a drug. Back in the olden days, back before we used to add potassium to a bag of fluid already hanging. Now it's so much nicer in that. I'm not saying you'll never have to do that, but a lot of your potassium will come already in your bag, and so it will be mixed and diluted. But just kind of remember that, or that's an oh, by the way. Sodium chloride. Normal is 135 to 145, so our sodium. This is the one that's principally outside the cells. And I always say about sodium and water go hand to hand. So they lose water and they lose sodium at about the same rate, usually. We give them sodium to treat hyponatremia. And then these, again, are the symptoms of, or signs and symptoms we would note of hyponatremia. So that's just a little kind of, oh, by the way, on those principal electrolytes. The bigger part of the meat for this is to talk a little bit about dehydration, because dehydration can be a huge, huge issue in kids. It's very easy for children to get dehydrated. Not so much to get overhydrated, but usually they can get dehydrated very, very quickly. Your book in your GIGU chapter, of course, that makes perfectly no sense to me. But anyway, there is on page 1520. It starts, and 1520, just a couple of pages in there, and it talks about dehydration, which is as a result of an acute GI. So I can see it from there. So basically, it's 1520 to 24-ish. So, and it talks about dehydration, gives you this information. There's a table. It gives you the comparison chart for dehydration. My table says minimal, mild to moderate, and severe. Their table, and we will go with their table. Their table says mild, moderate, and severe. So that's fine. If you're getting the idea, you need to pay attention to this table. I would most definitely pay attention to this table. And it gives you some things to be aware of, like in severe dehydration, they may be alert. They can go all the way to the other end and be comatose if they're severely dehydrated. Fontanelles, in moderate and severe dehydration, the fontanelles are sunken. So they are depressed. And they are actually sunken. Eyes, severe. You have deeply sunken orbits. Skin, or the oral mucosa, is dry. Skin turgor, and we haven't talked about, where do we assess skin turgor in a child? Best place to assess it in a child. Not in their arm like we do adults. The best place to assess it in a child is in their abdomen or on their bellies. If we pinch up skin on their belly, that's a better place to observe skin turgor. Heart rate will increase in severe dehydration, and then it'll go to the other extreme. It'll increase in rate, and then they'll start bradying down, which is major Houston, we've got a problem kind of deal. Urine output is also listed in this. Mild dehydration, they may have slightly decreased urine output. Moderate, less than 1 mL per kilo per hour. Significant dehydration, less than 1 mL per kg per hour. So basically, significantly less than one. So it's to a greater degree with severe than it is with moderate. So that table is pertinent. Unresolved dehydration, and that is a clinical reasoning alert in this chapter as well. Unresolved dehydration, and the issue with that, it can lead to hypovolemic shock and death. So that's a big thing as far as that goes, and that's on page, down at the bottom of page 1520. Nurses must be able to assess a child's hydration status accurately and intervene quickly. And you think it's no big deal, they're only dehydrated. In a child, it's a huge deal because their body composition is way different than an adult. You used to have a table and they're made up of a lot of extracellular fluid. So it was very impressive if you thought about it, but we don't want them to have unresolved dehydration, and we don't want them to go into shock. And the biggest thing to remember, because the child can compensate and maintain an adequate cardiac output, the changes in their heart rate, changes in their sensorium, and skin color are going to be earlier indicators of impending shock than by just looking at their blood pressure. In an adult, we would use the blood pressure to trend what's going on. In a child, because they can compensate, we need to look at their heart rate, their sensorium, are they alert, what's going on, and we need to look at their skin color. So those are the three things, because they're all earlier indicators of impending shock. So commit that to memory. Dehydration or IVVD. So you might see a diagnosis of IVVD. Intravascular volume depletion is one of the most common causes of hospitalization in infants and children. So again, that's an interest and an, oh, by the way, that we must be cognizant and aware of. Told you that book was heavy. Management of dehydration. We want to administer fluid containing sodium by oral or IV route. Maintenance fluids, and we want to replace the loss over a 24-hour period. So this little fluid calculation that we went through earlier that we're going to revisit is for their maintenance fluid requirements, what the body normally needs in a 24-hour period. So that's our maintenance fluid requirements. Potassium is only added after their urine output is adequate. So if they're still not voiding and their voiding is not adequate, we are not going to add potassium until that is so. If we can add sodium bicarb, if metabolic acidosis is present. Okay, the maintenance fluid requirements is listed again, and the minimum urine output is listed again. We need to think about for output, 1 gram wet equals 1 mL of urine. So if we're doing strict INOs and we're weighing our diapers, so the parents, whomever, will collect the diapers, will weigh them at the end of 8 hours. Usually they don't do 12-hour shifts for INO. They do 8-hour shifts for INO. So at the end of 8 hours, we can weigh. And what we do is we weigh the wet and we subtract the weight of a dry diaper. And that way we can come up with the amount of output that they are having. We think about nursing considerations. And I said earlier, we want to replace this by oral or IV route. Oral is the better way to go. If we've got a child that's mildly dehydrated and our parents recognize the symptoms, then we want them to start oral rehydration as long as they're alert enough to take oral fluids. Your book has information about that, how you can even make your own oral rehydration solution. These days and times, it's much easier to go to the store and buy Pedialyte, Rice Light, or any of the generic oral rehydration solutions. They even make them in popsicle form. So we want to get them rehydrated, and oral is the best way. If they're severely dehydrated, then we would, of course, go the other way and think about admitting and giving them IV fluids. We want to avoid sports drinks and soft drinks. Anybody know why?
Sugar causes dehydration.
Sugar causes dehydration. Very, very good. And a lot of those, even the vitamin waters, if you're not aware of labels and you're not looking at labels, look at the labels on some of the vitamin waters and the things like that. Plain, mild to moderate oral rehydration is the first intervention if they're alert enough to take it, if they're alert enough to take oral fluids. And potassium is added after urine output is adequate. I'm looking in the chat box at the same time. So, but if they're alert enough to take oral fluids, we want to give it the oral route. We don't want to do sports drinks. We don't want to do soft drinks. We don't want to do straight water, because that's not good either. Remember, sodium and water go hand in hand. And then again, severe dehydration will require IV fluids and electrolytes. So, what are we going to do? We talked about rehydration. We're going to assess their hydration status, right? Assess their hydration status. We're going to look at their skin turgor. Pinch up on the belly, see what our turgor is. We're going to look at fontanelles, if they're old enough to still have a fontanelle. So if I put in a question, assess fontanelles, and I'm dealing with a three-year-old, is that going to be in the answer? No, a three-year-old doesn't have a fontanelle, an anterior fontanelle, that we should be able to assess. So think about that. Monitor intake and output. Again, they should have a minimum of 1 to 2 mL per kg per hour. Monitor their weight. And that's, you know, we talked about doing their weight in kilograms. Best to weigh them same time every day, same way every day. Weight loss or gain of 1 kilo in 24 hours represents 1 liter of fluid loss or gain. On an adult, if they're dehydrated, a lot of times you can see it. On a child, you won't necessarily notice it. if they lose 1,000 milliliters, you better be noticing it, and you better be intervening pretty quick. So we need to think about that. Education, we want to talk to these parents, families, everybody about the signs and symptoms. What do our parents need to look for? They don't know necessarily. So like number of wet diapers. It is normal for an infant child to go through, correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Wood, 6 diapers a day. Should have 6 wet diapers a day.
That's a good number.
Okay, she agrees. So they're supposed to have that. If they're not changing their diaper, then we got a bigger problem, because they're not putting anything out. And if that urine output, if they're oliguric, then they're severely dehydrated, and we've got a bigger problem. What about tears? Now, we would see if they're crying, they're upset, whatever, you might have an absence of tears. Not as a normal thing with a normal newborn. You might have absence of tears because they're just so doggone dry. Look inside their mouth. Is their mouth sticky, or is it dry, dry inside? Are they irritable? We haven't said it yet, but we'll say it now. Just about every condition a child might have is typically going to make them irritable. They do. They get irritable. They get cranky. They're just not happy. So they're irritable. If we go to the other extreme and they're difficult to awaken, that's not good. Because they're like in the realm of severely dehydrated, and they're at risk for shock and death. Think about fontanelles. We've said that before. If they've got a fontanelle, if their fontanelles are closed, what about their eyes? Do their eyes appear sunken? Sometimes you can look at a child and it's like, those eyes look a little bit sunken. That skin turgor's not really good. They don't want to drink or whatever. We need to talk to our parents about what type of oral rehydration fluids we can give them. So we need to talk to them about that. We need to talk to them about prevention. As I said, intravascular volume depletion is a leading cause of admittance to the hospital, or can be a leading cause or a big cause. So we talk to them about prevention. Goes back to really basic. Hopefully by now with COVID, everybody's learned this, but wash your hands. If the child's vomiting, if the child has diarrhea, it makes common sense to wash your hands. Does everybody do that? Not necessarily. But think about that. And we just want to think about prevention of dehydration. So if parents are able to note this early, hopefully they can head it off and take care of it before it becomes severe and a major require hospitalization concern. Got when to call the pediatrician or healthcare provider. It's very important in babies younger than 6 months of age that they seek assistance earlier. So again, if they're typically very, very young, we need to seek assistance earlier with those little babies because it is so much more of an issue. So I'm very, very proud of you for how well you hung in. One more little thing before we go. You're like, oh my gosh, not one more thing. But there is, there's one more little thing, and I promise you we would do this. I just have to find it because it's posted in. I know which one. Oh, fluid hydration calculation. That's the one. It's listed under some quick problems. And I know it's 4 o'clock. Of course, I did say we might go to 4:01. So anyway, I'm going to share this really, really quick. And again, it is posted. Ooh, got it all over the place. It is posted, so you can go back and you can look at it later on for clarification, or to assist you in any way, shape, or form. So, formula for fluid maintenance. So, here again is the formula. Memorize 100 for the first 10, 50 for the next 10, 20 for the last 10. This is the total mils needed for 24 hours. You would divide it by 24 to come up with your hourly requirement. We're not really trying to trick you. Might seem like we're trying to trick you, but we might come up and say, okay, so what is the fluid requirement for an 8-hour period or for a 12-hour period or whatever? But this is something you should be figuring out every day on the floor with your patient. If they have an IV hanging, you need to make sure you know what kind of IV they have. You need to look at your IV site, you need to look at your IV pump, and you need to look at your rate, and you need to kind of figure out if that's where, in fact, you need to be. So I think it's very, very important. So next one, practice. So a 23-kilogram child, what would be their need for 24 hours, we'll say? 100 mils times 10, that's that first 10 kilos, right, equals 1,000. 50 mils times 10 is the second 10 kilos. So that now we're at 1,500. 20 mils times 3 equals 60. So 1,000 plus 500 plus 60 equals 1,560. So they require 1,560 milliliters per a 24-hour period. If you want to figure out what they need hourly, you would divide that number by 24, and they would need a normal maintenance requirement would be 65 mils an hour. So when you break it on down, it's not too scary. 40-kilo child, 100 times 10, 50 times 10, 20 times 20, 1,900. Divided by 24, so they need 1,900 per 24 hours, or they need 79.16 mils per hour. And a lot of our pumps can set it at 79.1 or 79.2, just say. So we can figure it out. It's important. Why is it important? So you can check and see if your rate is correct for the child. You will calculate this daily in clinical, as I said, on your client as soon as you get report and check the IV pump. We also need to discuss oral intake. We might need to adjust the IV rate based on their oral intake. They're drinking a lot as opposed to not drinking at all. And that can lessen or decrease the rate. So again, pretty easier. Some healthcare providers will order 1.5 times maintenance, especially if they come in and they're dehydrated, which is maintenance times 1.5. So if a 6-kilo child needs 600 per 24 hours, they would need at 1.5 times the rate or the maintenance rate, they would need 900 in 24 hours. So that's the change in volume. And this depends upon your provider, the degree of dehydration. For severe dehydration, we usually do 200 mils per kg per 24 hours, and we're usually using normal saline or Ringer's lactate. Mild and moderate dehydration, 50 to 100 mils per kilo per 24 hours, or oral rehydration by mouth. And we've already talked about what that includes. It does not include water, milk, undiluted fruit juice, or soup or broth. That's Pedialyte, Infalyte, Rice Lite. So those are the things in regards to that. practice, child weighs 25 pounds and 5 ounces. So that child weighs 25.31 pounds, or when we divide it out, 11.5 kilos. 100 times 10, 1.5 times 50 for our second 10, or in our second 10 kilos, equals 75. So they would need 1,075 for 24 hours, or 44.79 per hour. Six pounds, 4 ounces, 6.25 pounds. Again, formula stays the same. We're in that first 10, it's just 100 times, and it's pretty easy to do. The urine output, we've talked about that. These are the same numbers that I gave you. You weigh diapers, subtract the weight. Again, this information is in here for you. Teach your family to assist you to collect and mark on the INO sheet. Check the diaper pail for empty at the beginning. And with our INOs, as I said, we collect our INOs every 8 hours. Even if the nurses are working a 12-hour shift, they do it every 8 hours. So that was just an interesting something I figured out too. 10-pound infant, what is the minimum output in 8 hours? 10 divided by 2.2, 4.54 kilograms. If we take 4.54, multiply it by 2 kilograms, we come up with 9.08. And if we do, it shouldn't be kilograms, it should be milliliters. But anyway, so if we come up with our minimum, it's 9.08. If we come up with our times 3 mils, it's 113.62. And you would multiply that by 8 hours. And so our minimum output would be 72.64 mils in 8 hours. So you're taking the nine. Pardon?
Sorry, I think the one got in there twice. So it should be 13.62.
Oh, yes, it did. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
So that is true. So we've got 9 and we've got 13. And then you're going to multiply and figure it out. And then again, they gave you the fluid requirement, 4.54 kilos times 100, 454 mils per day divided by 3, because we're talking about 8 hours, would equal 151 every 8 hours. So again, be aware as far as practice. So you see what is important, accurate INO and daily weight. They give us a lot of information, and it's crucial. It's very, very important in our pediatric population. So, stop sharing this screen. Okay, it is 4:10, and my backside is dragging. So, I am stopping this recording. Yay. I'm stopping this recording, and I will say